welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And here we are deep in the bowels of the Scientific Strategic Reserve's laboratory, I guess is the best way to describe this place. It's really like an operating amphitheater. But let's get into some details here. Hal, why don't you fill us in on minute 33?
Well, minute 33. In the bustling underground military facility in Brooklyn, Dr. Abraham Erskine strides into the lab, his voice warm but focused. "Good morning," he says to Steve Rogers, who flinches as a photographer's flash bursts unexpectedly. Erskine waves off the camera with a hint of irritation. "Please, not now." He turns to Steve, his tone steady. "Are you ready?" "Good. Take off your shirt, your hat, and your tie." Nearby, Colonel Phillips greets a sharply dressed man with a firm handshake. "Senator Brandt, glad you could make it." Senator Brandt, glancing around the humming facility, raises an eyebrow. "Why exactly am I in Brooklyn?" Phillips' jaw tightens slightly. "We needed access to the city's power grid. Of course, if you'd given me the generators I requisitioned..." Brandt cuts him off, dismissive. "A lot of people are asking for funds, Colonel." He gestures to a man beside him. "Oh, this is Fred Clemson, State Department," the man interjects smoothly. "If this project of yours comes through, we'd like to see it used for something other than headlines." Brandt's gaze lands on Steve, scrawny and bare-chested, preparing for the procedure. "Jesus," he mutters. "Somebody get that kid a sandwich."
Well, there's so many directions we can go off in this. Mostly, I'm always focused on sandwiches, but I feel that way.
Settle in, listeners. We're doing 45 minutes on sandwiches.
Yes, yeah, so stand by.
Well, we'll start with the Earl of Sandwich, of course.
Yes, and the Sandwich Islands. Let's talk a little bit about Brian. Something you had brought up before we started recording this beautiful laboratory. We love movie laboratories, and there's so many of them out there, and it's the bigger, the brighter, the more bustle there is, I think, the better.
Yeah, well, the prototype, of course, is Dr. Frankenstein's laboratory, which had, in my opinion, some of the requisite requirements. So, number one, a Jacob's ladder. Two antennas with the zippy lightning traveling up between them. Very good. I don't think Frankenstein had a Tesla coil, but a good laboratory needs a Tesla coil for no discernible reason. But it's got to be shooting electrical sparks all over the room if you can get one of those.
Yes.
Now, Howard Stark doesn't have either of those that I see in this scene, but... If a lab's got a Jacob's ladder and a Tesla coil, I know we're in for a good time.
Yeah, I think gauges are also required as time goes on. The more scientific you want to be, you need big dials and gauges and things that have red arcs of a circle that show danger and a knob ready to go past that danger line.
Right on past it. We see some scopes, of course, throughout here as well. Some oscilloscopes, which I think maybe by the 40s, when we started to see fewer Jacob's ladders and more oscilloscopes creeping slowly decades later toward the digital world. And there can never be too many like blinking lights and light up buttons.
No. Yes, ominous looking power coils everywhere. There's just snaking through the walls, and overlaying a bunch of things. But also with a cool, crisp designer decor. I mean, obviously they had to sit down with somebody at Westinghouse and decide what color enamel they were going to use on all the cabinetry, and the carefully rounded edges. You don't want anybody poking themselves on a sharp edge in a laboratory.
Westinghouse is a great reference, Jim, because this laboratory reminds me so much of what you would have seen in like a radio transmission tower or something like that in the 30s and 40s. It looks like, I was going to say an old TV studio. There weren't that many TV studios around the 40s, but something like that.
Yeah, well, radio is still being, working on broadcasting. I mean, FM radios where the heterodyne had been developed. And
radio was big. Radio was huge. I'm just thinking about, you know, old TV studios and that kind of thing. But really, they were more or less the same tech back then.
Yeah, no knife switches in this particular laboratory, but they do have the knobs with the fingered bevels on it. I do like the ability to get a good grip when you're turning a big 6-inch wide knob.
Yeah, I mean, what we're dancing around or hinting at is our admiration for the set designers who made this thing look period appropriate. It doesn't look like a 1960s, 70s, 80s lab. It doesn't look like a 1920s lab. It you know, the look of this thing, the art deco-ness of it, the streamlined modernness of it, the Airstream trailer-ness of it,
yes,
puts it right in its time period. It's beautifully done.
It reminds me of the third stage on the Carousel of Progress. It all feels like just a perfect set design. That and even the color, that seafoam green of all the appliances, for lack of a better term, that's what they are. They seem to be something that you wouldn't find out of place. There was a four burner stove in there somewhere.
Right.
Well, and this just occurred to me, but looking at, you know, the overview of this lab that we get from the balcony that Steve walks in, everything is arrayed in a semicircle around the chamber, that the coffin that Steve's going to climb into. And there's no particular, probably scientific reason for that, but a wonderful dramatic reason for that. Everything is focused on what's going to happen in this sarcophagus that Steve's going to climb into. And it just reminded me very much of the design of the bridge of the original series Enterprise.
Yes.
That's true.
Where Captain Kirk
sits. I was waiting my turn to say that exactly.
Oh, please go ahead, Hal, because it's a beautiful set of drama, dramatic set design that tells the story.
Yeah, that puts you right in the center. The other thing that stands out to me that also makes it a product of its time is that, you know, Brian, you pointed out we've got the bridge set there, everything's focused on Steve, and, you know, I view that circle around him, or semicircle around him, those are the sort of local controls, and we're going to monitor things, we're going to hit buttons and stuff. But then up against the back wall, you've got this bank of equipment, which gives me sort of an early ENIAC feeling or something like that. That's probably where the calculations are happening. You know, that's the big brain of it, but it's too big. It can't be incorporated into this more local focused spot where we're actually going to do the thing. So we've got our screens, we've got our buttons, but the stuff in the background there feels to me like it's what's really, really driving the whole thing. That may just be the electrical power, but it gives me that vibe that, like, you couldn't do all of this like you could now with only the equipment that would sort of fit in the circle.
I love that observation, and I'm gonna show my age here, but what you just said reminds me of an old TV show called The Time Tunnel.
I was just going that way. Yes, definitely.
Where, you know, it's a time machine, and for those of us, our listeners who've never seen it, the time machine in The Time Tunnel is basically a large circle that you walk into and you go back in time. And in front of that is a little console about the size of a desk, but off to left, off to the right, behind it, under it, is this enormous complex that just goes 100 stories straight down and it's 100 stories back. And it's all this stuff that is needed to make the time tunnel work. That's all controlled by this little panel in front of the big circle. And I think that's a great observation, Hal. I like that very much.
Definitely the point of the spear. It's just, I mean, there's this, right, a lot of people at the back of the spear pushing it along. And that it also reminds me of, if you've ever been to any power facility. I can remember being at the Hermiston Dam, where they regulate power coming, you know, the water flowing over the Columbia River turns these gigantic turbines. And many of the appliances or apparatuses that regulate that power look a lot like that back wall with the beautiful gauges. It looks like there's float levels and all kinds of things on there that we don't need to know about what they are, but they all seem to be. And they also, one of the things that the endless series of gauges that seem to be arrayed in rows and columns, that reminds me of the Krell's laboratory, Morbius's lab in Forbidden Planet, where you were measuring his mental power that was going up by factors of 10. So I was thinking, just imagine the energy that they're harnessing here, as we're going to get into in a future episode about draining half the power out of Brooklyn to just push into Steve.
Right. Yeah. This was, you know, I mentioned ENIAC a moment ago, and you know, maybe some listeners might not immediately resonate with that idea that this was at a time when we were starting to develop, you know, true digital computers, but you had things that were, you know, as big as a house, and they could multiply, divide, add, and subtract. And that was really, you know, that was really it. But the size, the physical size of the equipment needed. I mean, I would look at this room and say, okay, whatever computing power they need now, I could probably run it on my iPhone while multitasking 27 other things. But back then, whatever sort of needed to go into this, you would need all of that extra support beyond what you would just see, as Jim said, the tip of the spear.
The you know, a little moment in this that I was thinking about, if any of you worked in an old fashioned mainframe computer room, the floor that they're using. I have, when I moved into the house that we just bought, the previous owner had left this pair of suction cups that I can distinctly remember from using back in the 70s and 80s to lift those floor tiles up to get to the big cables, which I just looking at the layout of this laboratory, there must be giant power cables running between the back wall and the control panel. So it just gave me some tactile feel of the past there.
You both touch on something that's an interesting big sweep of history in our view of the future, which is that in the 40s, 50s, 60s, most people didn't predict the future getting small, the computation getting more and more compact. You know, if you'd said in 1950, what's a supercomputer look like? They'd say, well, it's the size of a city.
You know,
not. And there was such the transistor helped this, of course, and then integrated circuits and so forth. But a physicist named Richard Feynman did a wonderful lecture called "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." And the whole point of that is, you would not believe how much information you can pack into something the size of a couple of atoms or molecules, a couple of molecules, you know. You could store all knowledge in every library on the world in something the size of a sugar cube kind of idea. And that's the way it's gone. That's the way the future's gone. And nobody really foresaw that back then. You know, back then, more power meant bigger, more knowledge meant bigger. And instead, the actual future, our actual world of tomorrow, went absolutely the other direction. And it's fascinating. It's one of those developments that seems natural and obvious to us because we're living it. But at the time, it would have blown these people's brains, you know?
Absolutely. So, Brian, I had a quick question for you. In the various sort of times we've seen Captain America's origin story in the comics over the years, was there always sort of a combination of the serum and this power, the sort of electronic, almost digital machinery component to it? Or was there ever a point where it says, hey, I made this serum, you know, inject it and you're super?
Yeah, well, again, the original origin story is very economical. It's told in just a few panels, but it's always been this combination of, you know, Frankenstein style electricity, because electricity does everything in chemistry. They actually, I think in a little later in this scene, they're going to talk about Vita Rays, and Vita Rays come right out of the comic book. That was something that, you know, Dr. Reinstein invented in 1942 or four, or whenever, you know, they made the original Captain America. Actually, it was before 40, because there's that, the cover of Captain America 1 is Captain America hitting Hitler in the jaw. And we had not yet entered the war at that point. So it's, before 19, probably 1940. God, I should know that. I'm sorry. I'm here as the comic book expert, and I need to look this stuff up. Before this episode's done, I'll have that information. But yeah, it's always been this kind of, and of course, it changes with the times. I'm sure in the 60s, when they did flashback origin, it looked a little different. In the 80s, it would have looked a little different. But it's always been this combination of more or less steroids with some kind of electrical shocky kind of thing.
Well, it makes sense, though, because then that... without requiring all this other stuff, well, then this serum is something, you know, you just, I mean, as we see, it becomes a MacGuffin, but if you could just sort of smuggle it out in your pocket or in your Barbasol shaving cream a la Jurassic Park, and then anybody who took a dose you know, would get this, it really defeats the purpose that there's, it needs to be something this elaborate. And, you know, we see it across the Atlantic and with Dr. Zola, and, you know, we're seeing it here. So that's, I'm glad to know that that's consistent and true.
Yeah. Well, in the limited series, or the mini series, what was it? Falcon and the Winter Soldier that came years after this movie, they did kind of reduce it to what you're talking about, Hal, where if you had the right vial, you could, I guess, shoot it up and become a super soldier in 15 minutes. I think that was presented as, oh, here's what we can do 80 years later, you know?
Right.
And before we get too much further, Captain America Comics 1 was published in March 1941. So, and it actually hit the newsstands in December 20th, 1940, the internet tells me. So that's when Captain America was created.
That is really, really prescient when you think about it, that at that time, you know, I think for many people, the writing was obviously was on the wall that war for the U.S. was certainly a distinct possibility and a probability. But, you know, that he's there punching Hitler in the jaw at a time when the America First movement was still a fairly viable thing. And, you know, not necessarily all sympathetic to Hitler and the Germans, but certainly we don't want any part of it.
No. Well, there's certainly probably a master's thesis, at least maybe a PhD paper to be written about the fact that, you know, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby were Jewish. And in 1940, they had things to say about Adolf Hitler. Even before Pearl Harbor, they had some opinions they weren't afraid to express in their comic books.
I was wondering, I do not know this, and Brian, it's okay if you don't know this, but is Peggy Carter a comic book origin, or is she from the movie? I don't know where Peggy fits in on all of this.
Yeah, Peggy, there's an old story. Peggy Carter first appears in a story in which it's a one-off, and it's sort of the story of Captain America's lost love. He's already Captain America. He's in war. He meets this bold, daring Peggy Carter, who's, I think, if I remember right, been a long time since I read this story, working undercover in France during the war. She's part of the resistance. She's not French, but she's working in France. And at the end, they fall in love, and this is going to be forever. And at the end of the story, I think there's an explosion or something, and Peggy Carter loses her memory. So that's the end of the romance. But it's a one-off story. It's one and done. It's the great tragic romance, lost romance of Steve Rogers' life. And then in the Marvel Comics, when he's thawed out, Peggy Carter's still alive. She's middle-aged, but she's still alive. And she's working for S.H.I.E.L.D. And so they become reacquainted then. And I don't think there's much... I don't think there's a romance at that point. Because by then, we're talking about Sharon Carter, Peggy Carter's niece, who's also in these movies.
Yes.
And Steve has a little thing going with Sharon Carter. But they renew their acquaintance. Peggy and Steve renew their acquaintance in the 60s in the comic books.
Okay. Yeah. I'm looking through. I was just noticing in some of these still frames, Peggy is the only non-nurse in the entire arena there. And she stands out for not having a paper cap on her head. It's lots of white coats. I don't know if you have this experience. My wife has something called white coat syndrome, where if she goes to the doctors, her blood pressure is fine until she steps into a doctor's office, and then it'll go up about 20 or 30 points. And I just see all these white coats, and I'm just wondering, maybe they should be just dressed in mufti, some kind of, you know, wandering around in loose sweaters and, you know, dressed like Perry Como or something. But
it's so funny you bring that up, Jim, because I was just thinking about the other day. I do have hypertension, treat it, control it very, very well. And I have a physical twice a year. And then I have a pulmonologist that I see once a year, which is some other things. It's all very mellow and very low key, but I'm very proactive about it. I love my doctors, great relationships, completely open, friendly, honest. It couldn't be more relaxed and more easygoing. But when I go to the blood pressure doctor, the first reading, is 20 points higher than
it sounds like a good bowling score.
Yeah, that it, yeah, that it would normally be. Well, I've never, my blood pressure's never hit a perfect 300.
Okay.
Thank God for that. But I just noticed, I 2 weeks ago as we were recording this, I had my annual check-in with the pulmonologist, who maybe she would care about my blood pressure, but that's not why I'm there. And, you know, let's go and sit down, they take the blood pressure, and it's just, it's absolutely fine. It's one of the best readings I've had in years. And again, when I go to the other one, if you ask me, if you watch me, you wouldn't see me. I'm not nervous. I'm not stressed about it in any kind of discernible way. But it's become a running joke, and the doctor will say, yeah, white coat syndrome. We'll take it again at the end. It'll be normal and nobody's worried about it and everything else. But I'm with you.
Does your doctor do this when my doctor wants to take my blood pressure? I mean, they have me come in, and mine's a little high too, like a lot of people's. They'll put me in a quiet, dark room. They'll put on a nature video with quiet music, and they'll just let me sit there quietly for like 10 or 15 minutes. And it reminds me so much of the end of Soylent Green that
and
my blood pressure,
Robinson, yeah.
My blood pressure just spikes, man. Oh, the room stresses me out so much.
Yeah, that would weird me out. No, my doctor doesn't do anything like that. My dentist is good at spoiling me with a heated massage chair and, you know, neck pillow and the Netflix on the ceiling with wireless headphones and stuff like that. But they don't take my blood pressure there, so it doesn't matter.
My experience, I just recently went back for another, I don't have a thyroid anymore, but they always check to see if I'm growing a new one. So the new thyroid doctor that I have here in North Carolina, they'll do this thorough check of my neck, and he'll put his hands on my throat and then run it up and down under my chin and around my back. And it goes on for about 5 minutes or so. And I just close my eyes, and it's just like I'm having a spa day. I mean, I know he's checking to see if I'm, you know, metastasizing across my lymph nodes, but it just feels so calming. I wish I could take my blood pressure at that point, because uncomfortably intimate. Yes. It's just worth the trip. Thank God for Medicare. I needed that.
Before we stop talking about labs, I had a note and I didn't want to forget about it, but we were talking about, you know, every good lab has Jacob's ladder, every good lab has Tesla coil and the knobs and the everything. And I used to be a chemist. I was an environmental chemist, and something I look for in every laboratory. Now, this laboratory doesn't have flasks and test tubes and all that stuff. It's an more electrical biological lab, but in every lab that's got test tubes in it, they always color them every color of the rainbow. They're blue,
yes.
They're red, they're
mouthwash,
green, they're every color of the rainbow in the test tubes. Anybody who's spent any time in a real laboratory knows that 98% of the liquid in a laboratory test tube or flask is yellow or brown, because you're digesting something. They're all yellow or brown, and it's something I look for in every lab. And so if somebody gets it right, I just give a little salute to whoever designed that set, because that person has been in a lab. You know?
There's also an unusual number of Erlenmeyer flasks. I've noticed that for some reason you can't have test tubes. You got to have a flask, and it's, well, I mean, I can understand if you're trying to keep something corked and you're trying to boil it out, but it's the percentage of Erlenmeyer flasks that are sold to TV laboratories and film laboratories is unconscionable.
Well, they look good. They look, and the, the volumetrics, you know, the ones with the big bulb on the bottom, volumetric flasks, perfect. Very, very photogenic.
Very photogenic.
And so, they're always unattended boiling.
Yes. And there's always some open flames around just in case.
Yes.
You never really have to go and light one. That's not a Bunsen burner. What is that when you see it in the lab, that you would heat a flask over?
Well, I don't know, because in my labs we use electricity. So,
amateur. Wow. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, okay, Mr. Late 20th century.
Yeah, future guy. Brian, I'm not sure about you, but I think one of my favorite labs that Hal and I have shared is the one in October Sky, because if you can't throw something flammable down a sink and have every other sink in the classroom burst into flames, why bother going to school?
Right. Why even take chemistry if you're not going to lose an eyebrow over?
I think that's a lovely example. Another one you guys know all about is Wildfire and the Andromeda Strain.
Yes.
Which to me is just the perfect movie laboratory/secret compound. I mean, it's just I was going to say so realistic. I don't think it's realistic, but it has just this feel of verisimilitude. It's like somebody would have built that in the 70s.
Yeah, it is the ultimate in PPE. I have to say, they go way past rubber gloves. I don't think I'd want to have my outer epithelial layers burned off. But it's amazing how much of that movie is devoted to hand washing and cleanliness.
Yes.
You guys got me thinking about all of our favorite labs and things like that. If there was one fictional one that I could visit, I'd be curious if you guys have a favorite. I haven't spent a ton of time on this, but the one that comes to mind just from the hip would be the Batcave, the
Oh,
60s,
ah,
the
yes. Wait,
66
okay.
Batman Batcave.
Hal, we did not conspire ahead of time. I have a
We did
list
not.
in my hand of
Okay.
all the scientific
Oh,
equipment in
there
the
you go.
Batcave.
Oh,
Are
hooray.
you serious? Oh,
Yes,
that's
give
fantastic.
us
some examples there,
there's a
Brian.
couple hundred of them. But of course, he's got the Bat-cillascope, you know that.
Yes.
But there's a radio frequency bat generator. There's a bat spectrograph criminal analyzer, an Integro differential robot analyzer, which tells you if there's something weird about a robot. There's the brainwave bat analyzer, the electronic hair bat analyzer, a recollection cycle bat restorer, which restores lost memories. It just goes on and on. And of course, right in the center of the bat cave is the atomic pile, which has
Yes.
a sign on it which says super high voltage. It's got high, so you know it's super
Super high.
super
Yes.
high. He's got
It
his
always
own atomic pile.
it surprised me that it's not super high bat voltage.
It
Yes,
should
It,
be.
because I wouldn't you love loved to have been a fly on the wall in the writer's room when you're coming up with names for all of these things, whatever iteration, but the TV show took it so far over the top. And just arguing over, okay, where does the word bat fit in to the name of this gadget? Like,
Yeah, I think
in the
it's the
movie,
it has to be the third syllable from the end.
so you've got, well, but you then I
Or
give you shark repellent bat spray.
that's true.
Absolutely.
It's on the list.
From the
It's on the
movie.
list.
Well, I was wondering which computer was it that you had to feed vegetable soup in so you could figure out what the appropriate concentration of consonants and vowels were. I remember
Yeah,
that
the
movie.
alphabet
Oh,
soup. It
yeah. Soup.
unscrambled your alphabet soup.
Yes, and it would burp after they fed it. So, much like Robbie the Robot in Forbidden Planet, was trying to figure out how much Fusel oil was in Earl Holliman's flask. So,
Right. Or
but
his
I
vodka.
swear to God, Hal, we did not talk about this ahead of time. But I
That's
thought of the
amazing.
Bat Cave immediately because, man, it just that place fired my imagination. And of course, as a child, I took it all at face value. I didn't realize till I was an adult that it was a comedy. I thought that show was straight up.
Same here. I did the exact same thing. I was watching it in early reruns, just when I came around. But yeah, I just thought it was fun. It was action. It was adventure. It was serious. And that show in particular, not that we're going to do the 60s Batman minute, but it strikes me is that, like, at various points in my life, like as a kid, loved it for the reasons we just laid out. Get a bit older and realize, hey, this show was actually really, really pretty funny, and kind of sort of hilarious. You can rewatch it, enjoy it that way, and then further down the road from that, it became this absolute gold mine time capsule of
Yes.
the best of mid-century modern gadgetry and things. And it's like, now I can just sort of watch it frame by frame. Oh my gosh, look at the design of that. Look at this. Look over here. It's just
Well,
fantastic.
this is not the Batman minute, but I at one point my wife got me a set of all the episodes and I watched them in order, and I was struck, as you say, by the mid-century modern design. And what also struck, I started looking up the actors, whatever happened to. And what made me very happy was realizing that the Batman series was more or less a employment program for out of work character actors from the 40s and 50s.
Yes, it
That
was
the
the Murder,
producer,
She Wrote of the 60s. It was
the producer just gave jobs to all his old buddies. So that's why Catwoman's henchmen all look like 60-year-old, mobsters, is because they were mobsters in the, or played mobsters in the 40s. And I just thought that was delightful that to see that on that other level, that meta level of this was a TV show that a guy made so he could give jobs to his friends.
When I was seven watching it, and I had my aunt worked for the phone company, and I asked her, how did Batman get a phone in the Batcave that went directly to Commissioner Gordon's office, and wouldn't the phone guys know where the Batcave was? And she thought about this for a while, and she said, well, the phone company isn't allowed to tell any secrets about their customers, so they would never tell the police or anybody where the Batcave was. And well, I still believe that to this day.
there was an episode where Commissioner Gordon thought Batman had gone bad, and they basically dig up the phone line to try to trace it back to find him. But Batman I forget what it was called, but like a phone line derouting switch or something that he threw. And it led them to some old guy in an apartment that Chief O'Hara bursts into it. I gotcha, Batman. And the old guy's,
And all thanks to a phone line derouting bat switch.
Yes. I just made that up, but I bet I'm not far off.
I wouldn't doubt it for a minute.
Well, great laboratories and TV and movies.
Here, here, and light up red phones. I've got one of those, and without a landline now, there's not much I can do with it. But I used to have it set up. It was a sort of a rotary style phone, but it just had the circle with no actual dial in it, so it was sort of receive only. But it was connected to our phone line at our old house. And so when the landline would ring, that would flash red. And then I had a smart switch with that would flash the bat signal on the ceiling.
I love that.
Felt right.
Speaking of labs, I would be remiss if we didn't talk just a little bit about Tony Stark's lab in other Marvel movies. I love him and his robots with personalities. He puts hats on them. He insults them. He tells them they'll be working in a high school shop if they don't behave. Tony Stark's labs were just, they were 21st century labs, all 3D holograms that he could manipulate with his hands, and robots that would paint his armor cherry red if that's what he wanted. And in their own way, I think just as wonderful and of their time as his dad's lab is in this movie.
Absolutely. But so interesting to see the different attitude. We see young Howard Stark in this, and we get a little taste of that sort of that playboy attitude and things like that. But he's obviously doesn't go to that same extreme that his son does, but it's,
doesn't he? I think he kind of does.
You think so?
I think it's like father, like son.
Yeah. He does fondue. We know that. Well,
we will know that he fondues, but,
I mean, he made a super soldier, that ain't nothing.
That's true. And I don't mean his achievement. I guess I think of him, as we see later incarnations when he ages and he's trying to become more of the Disney analog, and with that wonderful throwback film we see of the City of Tomorrow in was that the beginning of Iron Man 2? That we see that.
Yeah.
I see him being just, he's a little bit more restrained than Tony's, at least his public persona. But
I always think of Howard Stark as a Howard Hughes if Howard Hughes hadn't gone crazy,
It's absolutely. He definitely his family life seemed to have calmed him down a bit. He less fondue, more substantial citizen, I think. Afterwards he became more of a benefactor, more of a Carnegie, and
Well, he also became a weapons manufacturer. I mean, that's true. That's what Stark Industries did before Tony reformed him. He became a government. Howard became a government man because he thought it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, intriguing. But more of this coming up in the future. We always like to hear from our audience, and be interested in hearing what audiences have, if audiences have a favorite lab or mad scientist or not so mad scientist of things that we've probably missed a bunch. And I'm sure there's people are yelling at their, as we've been told before, people do yell at our show. So if you feel like yelling at the show, we do want to hear from you. Go out to the the Facebook page that we have, Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base. It's out there on Facebook, easy to find. But thanks for listening here. If you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.